Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University History Department titled Empire, Federation, Union, Globe, Power Beyond the Nation in the 20th Century. Our speaker is Frederick Cooper, professor of history at New York University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, History Department Chair Bruce Shulman.
Currently professor of history at NYU, Frederick Cooper took his BA from Stanford and his PhD from Yale. He taught at Harvard and for a long period at the University of Michigan before occupying his current position in New York. A member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, he is the author, co-author, and editor of more than a dozen books, including Colonialism in Question, Theory, Knowledge, History, Decolonization in African Society, On the African Waterfront, Empires in World History, Power and the Politics of Difference, which won the World History Book Award in 2010, and most recently, Africa in the World, Capitalism, Empire, Nation State. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Cooper.
I'm grateful to the organizers of the seminar for inviting me, Professor Shulman for his generous introduction, and to all of you for coming here to listen to what I have to say on the subject of empire, federation, union, globe, power beyond the nation in the 20th century. Last December, one of the founders of the Workers' Party of Kurdistan, long considered the advocate for the national self-determination of Kurds, told a reporter that his party, quote, is not an independence movement. We are hostile to the dividing up of Turkey and more generally opposed to the concepts of nation-state and of borders, end quote. In the 1940s and 1950s, leaders in French West Africa had said much the same thing. They wanted autonomy for each territory and to turn the French Empire into a French federation or confederation in which all inhabitants would have a full voice. The Senegalese leader Mamadou Dia asserted in 1955, quote, it is necessary that the imperialist concept of the nation-state give way definitively to the modern concept of the multinational state, end quote. What at first seems to be the dominant political trend of the 20th century, the transformation of a world dominated by empires into nearly 200 sovereign nation-states, turns out to be something more uncertain. The empires as formerly constituted are gone. But the emergence of an alternative has been contingent and contested, and its future is unclear. The breakup of the Ottoman Empire in 1923 is yet to be fully digested. The relation of state and nation is violently contested in Israel-Palestine, Syria, and Iraq. In ex-Yugoslavia and Rwanda in the 1990s, efforts of some groups to make state conform to nation resulted in ethnic cleansing and genocide. And other forms of political organization have appeared. The European Union distributes sovereign functions to both national and supranational institutions. Unilateral and multilateral intrusions by world powers into other states are seen as the protection of a common humanity or as a violation of sovereignty and a new form of imperialism. Scholars have been so concerned with defining an epoch or an age that they have trouble thinking through the unresolved tension among coexisting forms of political belonging. As colonial empires collapsed in the 1950s, scholars both embraced and tried to tame the narrative of nation-making. Modernization theorists saw the national form of the state as intrinsic to the transition from traditional to modern. Applauding the convergence of political forms to the system of territorial sovereignty that they thought had been developed in Western Europe. Communist theorists had their own version of modernization, converging on socialist revolution, for which the national republics of the Soviet Union provided one model, and the collectivized peasantry of Maoist China another. Social democrats saw that national citizenship in Europe provided protection against the adverse effects of capitalist development and a model for the rest of the world. Academics in newly independent states wrote their national histories, finding roots of the nation in the deep past and heroic struggles for independence in recent times. Then there were doubts. Not at first about the ubiquity of the nation, but about its promise of liberation. French agronomist René Dumont's False Start in Africa And Ghanaian novelist Ayikwa Armaz, The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born, began a litany of lamentations of corruption and incompetence in the governance of new nations. In the late 1960s and 1970s, schools of critical analysis, dependency theory in Latin America, the Dar es Salaam School in Tanzania, world systems theory in the United States, located the problem of the third world not in the specific history of colonialism, but in a deeper history of capitalist development that kept accentuating the gap between the center and the periphery. Marxists came to doubt earlier stage theories. In much of the globe, it seemed, capitalist development was not a stepping stone to socialism. Other revolutionary pathways had to be explored. American political scientists questioned the evidence for convergence of societies toward modern norms. And on the right, Samuel Huntington asserted that some societies were incapable of modernizing and advanced countries needed to contain forcefully the consequences of modernization gone wrong. But the loss of illusions about the redemptive qualities of the nation state did not necessarily imply that its apparent ascendancy was any less important as an historical phenomenon. Indeed, methodological nationalism got a new lease of life when it was wedded to a new scholarly trend, constructivism. In 1983, Benedict Anderson captured this trend with a brilliant book title, Imagined Communities. Nationalism, Anderson insisted, was a product not of primordial affinities, but of a process of social imagination on the periphery of empires among Creole elites. The successful claims of nationalists in the Americas to govern their own state created a modular form adopted elsewhere. This approach misses the extent to which imagination can focus on communities both smaller and larger than the nation. The American revolutions were revolutions within empire before they were revolutions against empire. Thomas Jefferson's call for an empire of liberty and claims of Brazilian and Mexican rulers to be emperors suggested that building empires was as much a goal of revolutionaries as destroying them. And the horizontal solidarity that Anderson thought embodied in national citizenship fit poorly with the vertical structure of politics that put Native Americans, slaves, and freed slaves on the bottom. With the breakup of the Soviet bloc after 1989, another narrative took root. Globalization seemed to go in the opposite direction of the nation-making argument. Nation-states were mattering less as capital, people, ideas, and culture flowed, a favorite word, across borders. Some pundits thought a borderless world was emerging. Globalization never was a word that conveyed much precision, and it had a lot in common with the old modernization argument, especially the quasi-scientific credibility that the ization gave to a fundamentally normative point. Modernization, globalization was both inevitable and positive. Anyone who didn't jump on the bandwagon would suffer for it, and the world market demanded that states conform to its dictates, including rolling back the social protections of the welfare state. For this reason, social democrats lamented globalization but accepted its reality. Still others saw a cultural and social reaction to globalization, as different people, whether territorially located or in diasporas, defended their particularity. The world, some claimed, was becoming post-national, a new stage following upon nation-making, while other scholars pushed globalization back to the 19th, or maybe it was the 16th century. Francis Fukuyama posited the end of history, as liberal politics and market economics became the only imaginable possibilities for the future. A few dissidents asserted that instead of lamenting the demise of the nation and of social democracy, one should embrace the unity of the world and look to a global multitude to revolutionize its nature, an amorphous conception of both power and opposition to it, if there ever was such a thing. But convergence theories did not come to grips with the unevenness of the world, not least with the long-term effects of imperial power. Modernization theory, for all its Eurocentrism, had repudiated the racist doctrines of colonialism. Freed of the colonial yoke, freeing themselves of their own traditions, the peoples of the world could now strive for progress and equality. The trend in the 1950s and 1960s was not only to repudiate colonialism, but to repudiate the memory of it. Some nationalists in the ex-colonial world wanted to write colonialism off too, For example, in Nigerian historian Jacob Ajayi's consignment of colonial rule to an episode in African history, no more important than many other episodes lying between two periods when African societies ruled themselves. For many people who had experienced colonialism, it was not so easy to forget. Its effects hard to erase. Scholarly interest in colonialism in the late 20th century is a notable instance of people reacting to the continued divisiveness of their era by rethinking an older one. The canonic text of this rethinking, although it is hardly alone, was Edward Said's Orientalism of 1978. And the outside admiration and condemnation of this book reflected what at the time was a controversial assertion that colonialism was not a mere sidelight of Euro-American history, but an intrinsic part of the constitution of the societies that regarded themselves as the vanguard of progress. Since then, scholars who applied to themselves labels like colonial studies, post-colonial theory, subaltern studies, or the imperial turn have found receptive audiences and virulent critics. Whether conceptualized in terms of civilization, culture, race, class, or gender, the global order was and is riven by distinction-making. Important questions were posed. Did the imperialist origins of the universal norms, to which much of 20th century thought pretended in liberal or socialist guises, discredit all such norms? Or, on the contrary, was it the interplay of universal norms and local idioms, of alliances and coalitions across lines of distinction, that had discredited colonialism? Political action takes place in uneven spaces, neither confined to local or national containers, nor spanning the entire globe. So too do political imaginaries. We need to ask how people at any point in time saw paths to the future, not just the path on which they ended up. For the rest of this talk, I want to look at political forms that existed and were imagined in the 20th century. In the early 20th century, the relationship between nation and state, empire and nation, was far more complex than the misleading hyphen in nation-state. Not that national sentiments weren't widespread, and in some cases deep, but whatever sentiments people had, they faced the reality of a world dominated by polities that did not limit their reach to one people. The new state of Germany, born in 1870, called itself a Reich, termed its ruler Kaiser, Caesar, incorporated French, Danish, and Polish speakers, but refrained from incorporating more German speakers, even when it defeated the Austro-Hungarian Empire. By the early 20th century, the colonies of European states plus Japan covered over 40% of the Earth's surface. Some scholars have attempted to reconcile the age of empires with the age of nations by positing that colonization was really the work of big states, for whom colonies were wholly subordinate rather than parts of a composite, unlike the empires of old. Yet imperial difference was more complicated than a dichotomy of colonizers and colonized. Empires remained combinations of territories, colonies, protectorates, dominions, and spheres of interest. Different sorts of empires had to deal with each other. It is better to conceptualize change as shifting repertoires of rule than as epical transformation. There were new developments on the empire front. Japan, venturing into Korea from the 1870s, taking over Taiwan in 1894-95, and defeating Russia in 1905, both followed a European pattern of empire building and claimed to be doing empire in its own way, acting as an Asian big brother. Qing China was much weakened but remained too big a morsel for European powers to swallow. The U.S. had its venture in overseas colonialism in 1898, complicating its continental empire building that had been going on throughout the 19th century. In short, in 1900, power in the world was concentrated in a small number of states within imperial reach, exhibiting a wide range of forms, some expanding, some hanging on, some with a more national conception of themselves than others, all acting in relation to each other and to the diverse populations that they held in a variety of asymmetrical relationships. Glenda Sluga points out that the apparently national politics of the early 20th century conceals a strong internationalist drive to forge organizations across nations and empires. A specifically imperial form of internationalism was being constructed in racial and civilizational terms. Scandals over murderous and exploitive treatment of Africans, notably in King Leopold's Congo, fashioned the distinction between an anything-goes imperialism and a respectable imperialism, claiming to be tutors and protectors of uncivilized populations. And if colonization was a product of masculine military valor, the administrative authority of men, and male sexual license, organizations of women of European origin helped to promote an ideology of bourgeois self-restraint and stable racial and gender hierarchies. Africa became the classic instance of a very colonial colonialism. The so-called scramble to take it over was an inter-empire phenomenon, less a driving necessity to seize resources or markets than an effort to prevent other imperial powers from doing so. The French government gestured towards a civilizing mission in Africa, but put little money behind it. European powers invested little outside of islands of settler plantations or mining operations, although white settler regimes in Algeria, South Africa, and elsewhere remade African lives more thoroughly. Both French and British governments learned by the time of World War I that remaking economy and society in Africa in their own image, or systematically exploiting it, was beyond their capabilities. Colonial empires, like empires of old, needed intermediaries. In most of Africa, outside of areas of white settlement, the very chiefs and kings whose supposed tyranny and backwardness was invoked to justify colonization reappeared as the incarnation of African traditional authority on which colonial regimes relied. African elites were both manipulated by colonial officials and manipulated colonial officials themselves, skewing patriarchal and clientage relations to their interests. One has to be careful about generalizations about the capacities of the colonial state or about colonial modernity. And what of the state in Europe itself? It had been over a century and a half since the idea of popular sovereignty had emerged most strikingly, but who the people were and where sovereignty lay remained uncertain in 1900. The dual monarchy in Austria-Hungary, 1867, the Ottoman Empire's experiment in generalized citizenship, 1839, and briefly in parliamentary governance, 1876, and the Russian Duma, 1905, were among the innovations in sovereignty regimes within empires. The French state, after 1871, reversed the previous monarchical and imperial regimes, reviving the republican vision that it dated to 1789. Citizens were all equivalent to each other with no mediating status groups, except that women could not vote, and most people in the rapidly expanding overseas empire were declared to be French, but not citizens. Activists and intellectuals were questioning the structure of all these states, sometimes their very existence. Feminism, especially claims for a female voice in politics, liberalism, socialism, and anarchism all challenged governments, whether they leaned to the imperial or the national end of the spectrum. The Tsarist regime had its Russianizing tendencies in the Siberian, Caucasian, and Central Asian Empire, parallel to those of Western powers. But it pulled its punches, making deals with local elites, recognizing the role of Islamic and other religious figures. The idea of Russian domination over others made little sense in a context where the autocracy claimed to rule everyone. And it was precisely this point that was bitterly contested by liberal socialist and anarchist movements in the beginning of the 20th century. Germany and the Scandinavian states took the lead in making the state social. The emerging welfare state in Europe was not primarily the result of claims grabbed out of the hands of the state by a militant working class, but came out of complex class compromises. In early 20th century China, a national movement was developing, sometimes trying to brand the Manchu elite that had ruled the empire since 1644 as foreign, and they linked their cause with movements in the colonial world against the rule of outsiders, and they also connected to a Chinese diaspora. But Chinese republicans had to contend with patrimonial elements, warlords and their followers, in different parts of the republic they established in 1912. States, in short, were moving in different directions in 1914, not necessarily towards consolidating themselves as nations. World War I was a war among empires, and its consequences are sometimes seen as a move from empire to a world of self-determining nation-states, but only if one reads history backwards. The empires of the losers were indeed dismantled. The Ottoman, Austro-Hungarian, and German empires, and the Tsarist Empire as well, did not die natural deaths. Pieces of the losers' empires were distributed to the winners. Japan's plea for a statement condemning racism was turned down. To be sure, people in India, Korea, and Africa read Woodrow Wilson's words as if they applied to them, but they soon found out that they were not intended to do so. Despite violent episodes from 1919 into the 1920s in parts of the European and Japanese colonial empires, the powers were at the time able to stuff the genie of self-determination back into imperial bottles. Colonial governments asserted their skill in maintaining the distinct cultures of their subjects, protecting them from inappropriate European models of citizenship and civilization. The aftermath of war witnessed both the rise of new models of empire, the Soviet and the Nazi, and continuity of old models. The USSR built on Imperial Russia's multinational mode of empire by recognizing multiple constituents, each subordinated to an autocratic center. It now termed itself a union, and its component parts national republics. Each republic had a similar structure, governed by elites from the predominant national group, all of whom came up through the Communist Party. The United States did not have a colonial ministry, but it had its repertoire of power at a distance, including a few colonies and a more extensive pattern of invasions and occupations that disciplined uncooperative local elites or prevented revolution. The inter-empire conflicts that had led to World War I would only be exacerbated by the combination of imperial continuity, destruction, and change. The breakup of the Ottoman and Austro-Hungarian empires led to waves of ethnic cleansing. Greeks expelled from Turkey, Turks from Greece, an unmixing of people in Central Europe. Revolts were repressed with enormous violence by Britain and Iraq in the 1920s and in Palestine in the 1930s. Self-determination revealed not the natural affinity of people to cluster in territorially defined nations, but the imposition of boundaries by some over others, as a small number of imperial states continued to exercise power. The League of Nations provided a forum at which the conduct of colonial powers could be questioned, but it left judgments, not to mention information provision, to those powers themselves. The mandate system made German and Ottoman territories into yet another part of the imperial repertoire of Britain and France and some other countries. The League did more to internationalize colonialism than to undermine it, to conflate universal standards of governance with imperial powers' claims that they themselves, and only they, represented civilization. In the colonial world, the 1930s depression deepened the involuted nature of the imperial unit, and the social crisis could be sloughed off onto a countryside deemed backward rather than impoverished. Then, in the late 1930s, when recovering production created new social strains without measures to relieve them, waves of strikes broke out in parts of the British Empire, including both the West Indies and Africa. The confluence of strikes and riots in the old plantation colonies and in those regions of Africa most integrated into a wage economy led top officials to realize that by tribalizing Africans, they had deprived themselves to means to think about and act on social issues in labor and urban life that were emerging as empire-wide issues. The spectrum of imperial politics of difference included the Nazis, but the line from the atrocities of German Africa to the Shoah is not straight. Neither anti-Semitism nor colonial racism was unique to pre-war Germany. But in the context of post-war humiliation and impoverishment, and of being stripped of its imperial stature, the virulence of Nazism emerged. Ruling real Africans or real Asians did not necessarily make French or British rulers more sensitive or humane, but it did force administrators to be more realistic about the limits of their power. Striking out against the cosmopolitan culture that had flourished in pre-war Germany, rejecting the balancing games played by past imperial rulers, including those of Germany itself, heaping contempt on international law, Nazi ideologues moved towards a conception of a new Third Reich as German domination over inferior races. They then developed a repertoire of power different from past empires. While in France, the Netherlands, and other countries to the west, Nazis co-opted racially acceptable intermediaries, they did not do so in Eastern Europe, although many Poles and Ukrainians might have seen Germans as potential liberators from the USSR. The plan to exploit the land rather than the people in the East was a disastrous failure. The Nazis were defeated by other powers with an imperial reach and more capacity to bring diverse material and human resources into the conflict. But the effects of war were quite different from those of World War I. This time, the winners were almost as devastated in human losses, destruction of cities and manufacturing capacity, and financial ruin as were the losers. The humiliating defeat that Japan had earlier inflicted on Britain, the Netherlands, the U.S., and France in Southeast Asia shook the confidence of elites in the natural domination of the white man, while Hitler gave racism a bad name. But it would require hindsight to conclude that the only alternative to the imperial past that was emerging at mid-century was the nation-state. There were several possibilities for political movements opposed to the colonial state. The national perspective was seized rapidly in 1945 in Indonesia and Vietnam, where Japanese conquest, in effect, forced the Dutch and the French to try to recolonize lost territories, something neither was able to do despite engaging in brutal wars. An inter-empire conflict created the possibility for anti-empire movements to seize power. In both cases, divisions within the national movements were substantial. India had the longest history of a nationalist movement, although it was only at the end of the 1920s that the Indian National Congress gave up the idea of seeking a federal structure within the British Commonwealth. And when Britain ceded power in 1947, the nations that were created, India and Pakistan, were not the single nation that had long been the object of political mobilization. A different sort of claim emerged in the Pan-African Conference of 1945, the latest of a series going back to 1900. African, West Indian, American, and other activists of African origin condemned colonial rule around the world and demanded a determinant voice in their own affairs. But the conference could not decide what institutions would govern a decolonized black world. Movements such as that of the ulama in Algeria saw themselves as part of an Islamic world. But alongside such affirmations of a deterritorialized belonging were political movements in more defined spaces. And by the late 1940s, they were finding that some of their demands could be met. Less familiar is the story of imperial and post-imperial federalism. Empire and federation both assemble different peoples. Both can look at sovereign power in layered terms, on an emperor as king of kings. Both can, on a federal and federated government, each holding defined powers. Imperial rulers thought that federal structures within them, the French in Indochina, the British in Central Africa and Malaya, might give regional elites a stake in empire and allow for economic coordination. But imperial federalism looked only to narrow elites. British efforts in Central Africa, for example, were fiercely resisted by African political parties that rightly feared that the federation would be dominated by white settlers. Federalism also appealed to leaders in Africa, who sought to balance their quest for self-rule with membership in a wider, wealthier, and more powerful unit that would give them a chance at economic, social, and political progress that neither colonial empire nor independence offered. Until very late in the game, almost all political leaders from French West Africa laid claim to the rights of the French citizen, a large degree of autonomy in their territories, and an equal voice alongside European France in the politics of the overall unit, now renamed the French Union. Senegalese politician Léopold Sédar Senghor argued that Africans should balance horizontal solidarity and vertical solidarity. These are his phrases. Horizontal of Africans with each other, vertical of them with France. The former without the latter offered only unity in poverty and weakness. The latter risked reproducing colonialism. But the two together posed a claim on the superior resources from a position of strength, citizenship, and solidarity. How much control Paris could retain and how far Africans could get in claiming political and social equality were the burning questions of politics in sub-Saharan French Africa in the 1950s. When France began talking in the late 1940s about some kind of European Union, it wanted to include its overseas territories. Otherwise, France would be dividing itself in two. Some of the architects of Europe actually wanted to create Eurafrica. The phrase is theirs, not mine. Thereby opening up a larger market for expanding African exports and spreading the burden of development finance to European partners, even despite the well-recognized risk that this might dilute French sovereignty. Senghor and other Africans saw both advantages and dangers in Eurafrica, insisting that Africa would not serve as the wedding China that France offered to Germany on the occasion of their marriage. Africans had to have a full voice in governing Eurafrica. In the end, the unwillingness of Germany and other potential members of the European Economic Community to pay the burdens or accept France's privileged position with its former colonies doomed Eurafrica. A federalizing exit from Africa stood in opposition to what Franz Fanon was advocating. Fanon's insistence, above all in his 1961 book, on the Manichaean nature of colonial society can better be read as a plea than as a description. For Algerian society was divided in far more ways than two, and Fanon was hoping to eliminate all middle ground. One can argue whether federalizing reform or national revolution a la Fanon was the more effective anti-colonial strategy, but in fact each enabled the other. The threat of more wars like those of Vietnam or Algeria led France to respond with concessions to the nonviolent politics of French West Africa, while the Algerian national movement's revolutionary strategy ultimately succeeded less by military victory than because decolonization by 1962 had become an international norm. In French West Africa, political and social movements had turned citizenship into a claim-making language for social and economic equality, equal pay for equal work, schooling for all, equal benefits for army veterans. By 1956, French officials realized that giving autonomy over internal affairs to African elected governments was the only way to distance themselves from demands centered on the French standard of living. For Africans, this measure turned out to be a Faustian bargain, for it devolved power to the individual territory, and leaders had real power of patronage and resources. In the end, French Africans could not agree whether African territories should affiliate with France individually or as a unified African federation. In 1960, French Africa backed into independence in the form of nation states, an end to which most leaders had been seeking an alternative, and which all except Guinea had rejected in a referendum held in 1958. Even Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana, the paradigmatic example of the nationalist road to power, turns out to be more complicated. In the mid-1950s, a movement from the colony's largest ethnic group, the Asante, called for an Asante nation, using much the same terms as Nkrumah did in calling for turning the British colony of the Gold Coast into an independent African nation state. The movement was repressed by Nkrumah's government. Nkrumah himself proposed, shortly after the Gold Coast became independent Ghana in 1957, named after an old African empire, to give up some of the sovereignty so eagerly sought in order to create what he called the United States of Africa. But the new Pan-Africanism turned into a Pan-Africanism of states and largely a mutual protection society of heads of state, even as struggles for liberation in Portuguese Africa and parts of Southern Africa dragged on into the 1970s to 1994 in the case of South Africa. An even wider post-imperial vision emerged from a meeting in Bandung, Indonesia in 1955. A great deal of myth-making surrounds Bandung. It was a gathering of states, not of peoples, and it did not found the non-aligned movement. Its achievement was to articulate a repudiation of colonial power on a global scale and a refusal to become client states of either the Soviet Union or the United States. But the reality of decolonization was that it reflected the narrow pathways colonization had created and left in place new states with poor resources, creating incentives for elites to find rich patrons and to play them off against each other, as was increasingly possible in a decolonized world. Decolonization seemed to replace the hierarchy of an imperial world order with the equivalence of nation states. Conflict would still take place, but it would be within each state, and hence no one else's business, or among states, which international relations experts thought they understood, although not without anxiety. The United Nations, with its plural noun and its General Assembly, recognized equivalence, even if the Security Council expressed the notion that some states are more equal than others. The distinction between developed and developing nations maintained a sort of hierarchy, but posited in its terminology that it was self-liquidating and that those on top should help those on the bottom along the road to equivalence. The U.S. played a much more active role in reorganizing the international system after World War II than it had after World War I, via the Marshall Plan, the Bretton Woods system, and its efforts to remake Germany and Japan into peaceful participants in a capitalist economic order. The U.S. was not averse to seeing a small number of powerful empires be replaced by a larger number of small nation states, which would be more open to American economic, cultural, and political influence, although Cold War rivalry, combined with the advent of relatively autonomous state actors, introduced a great deal of uncertainty. The premise of sovereign equivalence underscored not only the strategizing of states, but the thinking of scholars about how to analyze the last half of the 20th century. That premise has proven inadequate, and scholars have been grasping at new notions, globalization, network society, to replace it. In so doing, they have both exaggerated the ubiquity of the nation-state system in the early post-war years and exaggerated its decline in the latter years of the 20th century. They have presumed the fit between nation and state that was never so clear. Not only capitalism, but interstate relations reflect a process of combined and uneven development. Encased in their borders, the governing elites of the poorest states played a zero-sum game with their rivals to control the resources that matter most, sovereignty, and with it, access to foreign aid, contracts with multinationals, clients within the territories, and patrons outside it. A few ex-colonial territories, South Korea, for example, produced high rates of growth and an affluent middle class. Others, even well endowed with natural resources, have followed a disastrous course, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for instance. Many fall in between. Contrary to the advocates of market mechanisms, success stories like South Korea and Taiwan owe much to highly interventionist states. Contrary to advocates of a radical break with global capitalism, states that sought a revolutionary path, Mozambique, Benin, let alone North Korea, have succeeded more in alienating their own populations than in finding a route to prosperity. Looking at trajectories out of colonial empire should give perspective to something taken for granted today. The units that we seek to compare and analyze lack the analytical and moral fixity we ordinarily assume. Why should Malians' access to piped water or higher education be determined by the resources within Mali's borders? The history that created impoverished African states was not a uniquely African history. And for a time, French Africans made claims to resources as French citizens. Now they ask for foreign aid. It was an historical process culminating in the national form of the state that divided much of the world into donors and supplicants, complicated by Cold War rivalries and continually changing recipes for economic development. Political actors, scholars, and advocates have long been uneasy over precisely this point. The relationship of national units, other forms of community, and humanity in general. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948 listed social and economic rights alongside freedom from arbitrary punishment and free speech, although there was no consensus that such rights were juridically enforceable and the idea of social rights was opposed by the United States. Anti-colonial movements staged their campaigns not just in the name of self-determination, but in the name of social and economic justice. But after independence, they generally insisted that such questions were internal matters. In some eyes, such a conception is post-national, except that it's also pre-national and extra-national. and accept that border guarding practices of national states remain powerful. Debates over the relationship between a universal humanity and the practices of states have been ongoing since the 18th century. Pace San Moin. The civilizing mission of colonial powers was a solution, an imperialist one, to the problem. Juxtaposing a deferred convergence toward a European or modern standard with actual relations of exploitation, denigration, and repression. With decolonization, ex-colonizers could abdicate the responsibilities for the inequalities they helped to cause and treat inequality as either a technical problem or a given condition for in places like Africa. The investigations of Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, the military humanism of NATO's intervention in ex-Yugoslavia or France's in Mali, and the reforms sponsored by rich states, by foundations, and by individuals like Bill and Melinda Gates aren't so post after all, both in the sense of reviving older initiatives and in reproducing older tendencies to reify the distinctions they pretend to transcend. The tension between claims to sovereignty and human rights, as well as the asymmetries of the power to act and the power to define categories, are problems we have to live with and struggle against, but will not resolve. The laments from many on the left of the triumph of a neoliberal world order don't capture the way the world actually works. There is nothing very liberal about the most dynamic player in the world economy today, China, either in the role played by the state in the economy or restrictions on political action and expression. Capital may flow, but in China it needs the support of a powerful state. In Russia, it needs the support of Putin. While in much of Africa, the state can't provide the security and infrastructure that many investors want. On the other side of the equation, social democracy in Western Europe has not collapsed, despite pressures on it. And far-right parties try to exclude so-called outsiders from its benefits rather than give up social protection for themselves. Let me conclude. In 2000, the world was a very uneven place, organized around multiple forms of political affinity, institutions, and connections. The national imaginary proved inadequate, if not dangerous. Put together, states like Iraq had fallen apart. Rival claims to build a nation on the same space that produced decades of unresolved conflict in Israel-Palestine. Rulers from China to Egypt were suppressing citizens' quests for voice rather than reflecting them. Political imaginations were crystallizing around regional, religious, or ethnic collectivities, not just on the nations that claim states claim to embody. And super-territorial connections, such as Islamicist networks, made conflict more contagious. States, imperial or national, have always had their ups and downs. But for a time in the second half of the 20th century, the hope or illusion reigned that the notion of equivalent nation states, each addressing its problems within its borders and respecting each other's sovereignty, would produce a global equilibrium that the rivalry and oppressiveness of empires had rendered unattainable. The states that emerged from empires have followed different trajectories. And even in regions like Africa, where the emergence has been painful, it is more useful to think of brittle states rather than failed states. Not only borders, but incumbent rulers have proved remarkably durable. 40 years for Omar Bongo in Gabon, succeeded by his son. 33 years for Félix Houphouët-Boigny in the Côte d'Ivoire. Rulers who act as gatekeepers, controlling the point at which national economies encounter the opportunities of the outside world, are challenged for control of the gate by networks that cross borders, as well as by factions within the state. As Francis Fukuyama, now more pessimistic than when he postulated the end of history, makes clear, a basic problem of the state system lies in the inability of many states, in developed as well as underdeveloped parts of the world, to deliver the services that citizens expect and need, fostering a loss of confidence in law and accountability, and what he terms repatrimonialization. The most powerful as well as the least rely on personal networks and followers to accomplish goals. Change in state form does not go in only one direction. If the world at the end of the 20th century was post-imperial, it was in the sense of having passed through and been shaped by a trajectory in which empire was a fundamental factor. In China, the borders established by the Qing Empire defined the space political movements struggled for throughout the century. Republicans, warlords, communists, and the communo-capitalists of today. And China faces the problem previous dynasties faced. Tibetan and Muslim peoples at the frontier of the empire who remain distinct. The spectacular breakup of the USSR at century's end was made possible, and except for the Caucasus, relatively peaceful, by the supranational structure of the Union, which came apart along the lines of national republics. The Russian Federation remains a multinational entity, now trying to reestablish something like its previous imperial reach, relying on something like the patrimonial authority of its previous rulers. The breakup of Yugoslavia revealed the violence by which the rulers of some states try to create nations. After waves of ethnic cleansing in the region in the 1870s, 1910s, 1920s, and 1940s, there was still a lot of unmixing to be done in the 1990s. The United States continues to exercise its repertoire of power at a distance. Meanwhile, the European Union represents an experiment in political organization, a confederation of states ceding some of the most important prerogatives, money and control of borders, to more inclusive entities. Its very name, echoing the French Union and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, offers a useful ambiguity, reflecting the divisible and shifting structure of power that sovereignty has always entailed. Whether the European Union will capture people's political imagination, let alone resolve practical problems, remains to be seen. Meanwhile, Africans whose parents once entered France as citizens now face a Europe trying to define them as alien and excludable. They face arguments that even Africans with papers are incapable of living according to Europe's supposedly universal norms. Fear of Islamic networks spreading across space has escalated. But Islam, ever since the generation that followed Muhammad, developed and fought over different relationships to state structures. In the 21st century, the idea of creating a caliphate still has appeal in some quarters. The all-embracing vision of an Islamic order coexists uneasily with the reality of quite specific networks with their limitations and rivalries. They hold an attraction for young males who are unanchored in their respective locations in Europe and the Middle East and are available to different sorts of networks. But like many networks, these remain both long in their reach and narrow in their capacity. Scholars' difficulty in analyzing all of this reflects two self-imposed modes of thinking. One is the fallacy of epochs. We like to think of history as coherent periods succeeding each other. Hence, the age of empires, of nationalism, post-colonialism, post-nationalism, the age of networks, the age of globalization. The simultaneous existence of different forms of political affinity in tension with each other is harder to analyze. The second weak point is to think in terms of domination or freedom, rather than in terms of power relations that are both asymmetrical and not total. In the early 20th century, elites in the most powerful states believed that they had produced a world order, an imperial order based on a hierarchy of civilizations. In the late 20th century, critics and ideologues of the international order tried to articulate norms that balance the putative equivalence of states with values that supersede them: rule of law, human rights, gender equality, democracy, religious tolerance. Many internationalists stand accused of promoting supposedly universal values that are in fact European. But the radical defense of particularism misreads the multiple interconnections that shaped every polity and the way in which norms and connections beyond the polity have articulated with ideas and mobilizations within. Leopold Senghor had a more nuanced take on the problem, pointing to a tension without trying to resolve it between horizontal and vertical solidarities in a world that is both interconnected and unequal. The history of empires and the history of nation states have left their imprints on the political landscape, but they have done so in a more complex relationship to each other than epical succession and in relation to a more diverse set of alternatives than is usually imagined. Can we, as scholars, think less in terms of categories and more in terms of connections? Can we think of other people's political ideas without assuming that they are incommensurable with our own, more in terms of overlapping temporalities than in terms of linear time? Can we recognize distinction without reifying it? Think realistically about inequality without perpetuating it? The world in 1900 was a world of empires, and its apparent normality and solidity belied the limits of the actual exercise of power within empires and the dangerous conflict among them. The world in 2000 was captivated by a briefly held illusion of a world order in which liberal democracy had triumphed, whether in the form of a generally accepted national order of things or a world of flows and connections. Does the illiberal capitalism of China represent the future of the world? Will China become more national within its borders and more imperial within a wider Asian sphere? Will the more liberal states have to follow in China's footsteps, especially as the growing gap between rich and poor within as well as among states generates conflict and a perceived need to rule with an iron fist? Will regional alliances in Africa, Asia, and Latin America become more confederal in the manner of the European Union? Will Russia exercise increasing control over its near abroad, recreating a new version of a former empire? Will the United States prove to be a fading imperial power, more isolated and self-contained, or more aggressive in its defense of its position? Or perhaps more of an equal participant of a world of multiple centers and diverse forms of connection? 15 years into the 21st century, it is too soon to tell. Thank you for your attention.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Frederick Cooper, professor of history at New York University. Professor Cooper's lecture was titled Empire, Federation, Union, Globe, Power Beyond the Nation in the 20th Century, and was presented by the Boston University History Department. Tonight's moderator was History Department Chair Bruce Shulman. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kahlo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.